Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Lauren Wilkinson, author of the new novel, American Spy. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is author Lauren Wilkinson, whose debut novel, American Spy, has been named one of the best of the year by Esquire, Time, Vogue, and a host of other outlets. Inspired by true events, American Spy follows a U.S. intelligence officer in the tail end of the Cold War, a brilliant but often overlooked young black woman in the boys' club of the FBI. Marie Mitchell's career seems to have stalled out, but when Marie is given a dangerous and shadowy assignment, it threatens to change everything she believes about what it means to be a spy, a lover, a sister, and a good American. Lauren Wilkinson's writing has appeared in Granta, The Believer, New York Magazine, and The New York Times, among other publications. She was a 2013 Center for Fiction Emerging Writers Fellow and received her MFA in Fiction and Literary Translation from Columbia University. American Spy is her first novel. Lauren Wilkinson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lauren, I have to start with the question. When you put that last word on the page and sent it in, do you have any idea that this first novel was going to take off like it has and get you all of these distinctions?
Oh, no. You know, absolutely not. I just was so relieved to, you know, have something finished. It didn't occur to me that, you know, Obama would give it a shout out, you know.
Right.
That was beyond my wildest dreams, but I am I'm so glad it happened. It's unbelievable.
Well, I said it was inspired by true events, and that's true, but it's not just that it's inspired by true events, it's that true events are actually dropped right into your novel in ways that even surprised me, because frankly, I wasn't aware of the setting of this novel. So it wasn't until halfway through it that I thought, I think I'm going to check out where this place is and who this guy is. And we're going to talk about it. You can explain as much of that as we can without giving away the plot, or at least the ending, to the listeners here, because we want them to go out and read this. This is just a great read. So I guess the question is, why Burkina Faso? And once the why, then tell us a little bit about Burkina Faso.
Yeah, well, I mean, my hope when I was writing, it was exactly what you just said, which was that, you know, I would write something that was compelling enough and interesting to other people, and then they would go out and say, oh, what's the truth behind this fiction? Because I think Sankara is a really interesting historical figure. He is one of the characters in the book, a real historical person, a Marxist revolutionary leader of Burkina Faso in the mid-80s. You know, he's called the African Che. He was a very young guy, very charismatic, and I just hoped that there would be an audience for this real story in the United States. So that was, I think, you know, why Sankara and why Burkina. I mean, Burkina specifically, because I wanted to contextualize this real person. So, you know, I went there. I traveled to Ouaga, the capital city, a year before I actually ended up selling the book. And, you know, it was such a illuminating experience for me. And I just decided, you know, I really wanted to capture this place as well as I could, so I could better explain the real man.
So in what ways did your travel to Burkina actually have an impact on your writing in the way you describe? Because I want to talk to you about your knowledge of the CIA. It sounds like you were a CIA officer for years. I'm really interested.
If I was, I could never tell you.
Exactly. But getting back to Burkina Faso, what'd you learn? How does that work its way into your book specifically? And maybe that's impossible to answer. I don't know.
Well, it really, really helped inform my perspective, right? I wrote a couple of drafts of this book before I went to Burkina. And once I was there, I realized, oh, I want to tell this story, the only honest way for me to tell this is as an outsider, is as a person who I stayed in Wagga for 6 weeks, and that's around the amount of time that Marie stays there. So because that, for me, was the most honest way to tell it, I didn't want to tell it from the perspective of, you know, someone who had been born and raised there, because that just would have been dishonest to me. So,
sure.
You know, as a result, everyone is responding to Marie as they responded to me, which is, you know, as the, you know, American capital A. Mm-hmm. And just, it kind of became an interesting way for me to perceive myself, you know, when I was in that new context, and I supplied Marie with that same experience. So, yeah, long story short, it really did help inform the book, you know. Yeah, also just sites, you know, like when Sankara was, you know, the prime minister's place of business, the prime minister ministerial palace, I guess, is the former, you know, where Sankara formerly used to work. So just being able to see these places really helped me shape the story I was going to tell.
So for those listeners who might be geography oriented and they're wondering where in Africa is Burkina Faso, give us a rough estimate of that and how large this country is, or maybe I should say small.
It is in West Africa. It shares a border with Ghana. Mm-hmm. It's right to the north of Ghana.
Right.
And then I think that Ghana is the size of Oregon State, and they're comparable in size, mm-hmm. Burkina and Ghana, although I have such a bad sense of that. One thing that I keep getting, I am easily disoriented when it comes to size and space. And I was in Burkina for, you know, as I said, 6 weeks, and I was so confident that I knew where north, east, south, and west was. And I've gotten several comments that I've reversed them. So, you know, and I'm like, oh, that's cool to hear, but I definitely can't do anything about it now.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So I put like a city that's in the south and the north by, you know, just by accident. But yeah,
well,
we all have our weaknesses.
Right. It's interesting you say that, because in a way, as I'm reading American Spy, I'm thinking you could replicate this story from Burkina Faso in any number of African countries struggling to overcome colonial and their tribal past. I mean, Mugabe just died. And if you look at who Mugabe was originally, it's not who Mugabe turned out to be. And in a sense, yeah. I suppose there's many of these African countries that in their struggles, as I said, to overcome their colonial and their tribal past, were setting up people like Sankara to do the job, but it didn't always work out.
Yeah, it feels like there is a pattern that we keep seeing over and over again with, you know, countries trying to establish themselves after having an extensive colonial history, and then the influences of the former colonial powers and then of the United States. It happens all over. So, I mean, for me, that was especially important because, you know, I can't verify any of this. This novel was fiction, but I wanted it to be plausible. And I feel like the way for me to do that was to choose to, you know, point out that pattern and put it in this particular context, because odds are, you know, something similar could have happened. So
right.
What you're describing is something I really wanted to talk about and illuminate with this.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Lauren Wilkinson, the author of American Spy. So the CIA intelligence officer, Marie Mitchell, in this book, I mean, by the time you get into this book, and by the way, the listener should know that your first chapter just forces the reader to get into this book and finish it, because you have the most exciting first chapter. You're trying to figure out, whoa, how did this happen so quickly? That's really cool. But as you get into the book, you get a real sense for CIA lore. I mean, your work has been compared to Le Carre, or however you pronounce that man's name. I've heard it pronounced a dozen different ways. And in reading some of his books, I can understand how this great novelist would be alongside your work, or your work would be alongside his. What's the deal here? Okay, let's assume you're really not a CIA spy. How did you figure this all out? You have a friend who's a CIA spy? What's going on here?
No. First of all, thank you, because Le Carre was one of my great influences. I love so many of his books and read a bunch of them. So my grandfather, Marie's father in the novel, is the deputy police commissioner of New York.
Right.
That's the most true thing. My grandfather was, he retired the year that I was born.
I wondered about that.
Yeah, he spent some time at Quantico, you know, and kind of gave me first-person accounts of his experience there that I use for little details. But really, it was just a lot of reading, a lot of research, a lot of reading first-person memoir of CIA officers and reading about the FBI. One in particular was that comes into my mind was called Blowing My Cover. I think the author is Lindsay Moran. It was published, I think, in 2003. So, you know, later on than Marie, but certainly the experience that I believe a female officer would have in the CIA or would have had, you know, 20 years earlier. So, you know, I just used other people's stories and then extrapolated using my own imagination. So I hope it feels real. But yeah,
there's no question about that. So back to how real Marie's life really is, as far as you're concerned, is it her father that was a New York police officer in the book? Marie?
Yes. And I also...
Is that what your father was?
My grandfather was. And in a lot of ways, Marie is like my mother. And I had forgotten one detail, is that she was actually recruited by the CIA in the 80s.
Oh, my gosh.
And she did not opt for it, but she was recruited to intelligence. She was really, they attempted to recruit her. She is my mom is brilliant, you know, and I think that she was a social psychologist and they wanted her to do that. But she had an interview. And then after that, she had this little red address book. And I kind of give that detail to Marie, that she had this little red address book that disappeared after her interview. And it made her, it sort of stoked some paranoia in Marie, the character, as it stoked it in my mother. So
is your mother Elsie? Is that
Elsie's my grandmother.
Oh,
my mother is who the book is dedicated to, Linda Perry.
Oh, okay. Because I ask because in the acknowledgments you thanked Elsie Wilkinson for sharing memories with you. Well, as you're writing this book, are you telling your family how intricately involved they're going to be in your new novel? Or are you saving all this for the day they open it up for the first time?
You know, denial plays a big role, I think, in writing. You just kind of, every single day you get up, you tell yourself, okay, at some point, you know, even if I can't see the finish line today, it's coming. And then you kind of, a little bit of denial about how people were going to react, I think, is also very, very crucial. My mom started getting texts from friends who had read the book before she even read this final draft. You know, she's before the book that came out, and they were like, oh, this has to be you. You know, I see so much of you in this. And what was really unsettling for me was that 9 times out of 10, when someone said that, it was a scene that was very much about me, my emotional life. So I was like, uh-oh. that has been it. I mean, no one has been too insulted, because really it isn't like
I'm not trying
to lambast any of my family members. But I did kind of draw from, you know, the people.
Yeah.
I drew from people that I love, you know, so in order to, you know, produce characters that I also really care about. It was a little bit of a trick, I guess, for myself to get me engaged with the story.
Yeah. And to the contrary, you know, I just look at it like your family must be over the moon. Not only the fact that this novel is successful, but that there's elements of family history in here. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I just actually had lunch this weekend with my grandfather, and he just moved to an assisted living place in Queens. And so, you know, everybody that who stopped, you know, to speak to us, he would say, oh, here's my granddaughter. She just wrote a novel. And like, he has like a poster of it on the wall to his apartment, you know, the door rather.
Right.
So he is very, very proud.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, one of the underlying themes of your book is really the tension between the Western ideal of democracy and the real politic way things work in many of these African countries. In a sense, I touched on that a moment ago. And I'm going to read you a quote. Well, I'm reading our listeners. You wrote this quote. It's from Thomas Sankara. And he's talking to Marie Mitchell, trying to help her understand who he is as a revolutionary leader. He said, "You don't understand this place, but you think you know what's right for it. Democracy isn't a thing that you conform a society to. We can't just import a system from the West. Real democracy has to develop in response to the needs of that society." That's really a very insightful moment in your novel, when I think you really get the listeners or the readers' attention when it comes to the difficult challenges these countries face when the United States sometimes seems to expect them to overturn their colonial ways or their tribal ways immediately without, you might say, going through an intermediate process that doesn't look good to Westerners. Could you comment on that?
You know, there's also just so many factors at play as well, right? You know, so if you are going to be, quote unquote, establishing democracy in a country, but also that same country is under extremely onerous debt from the World Bank, you know, it's like, how do you navigate those two things? If you want a country to thrive, but its social policies are hamstrained because there isn't enough money to finance them because they have to pay back a lot of money, you know, functionally, how is that supposed to happen? I mean, I feel that at the heart of this book and at the heart of a lot of this issue in general is the theoretical thing, what everyone anticipates, and then how it functions practically on the ground, and the huge gulf between those two states of being.
As a matter of fact, in real life, wasn't Sankara's successor the guy who played more with the United States and the monetary fund or whatever? I mean, the fact is...
Yes.
He was the one that said, "Hey, look, we've got to correct some of these things. We're going to conform to the demands that are placed on us by the West." I'm probably simplifying that. But.
He did, but, you know, and then, of course, it's the trickiness of it. He was in power up until a couple of years ago, more than, you know, 2.5 decades. He shut down all of the social policies and programs that Sankara was known for. You know, like the literacy campaign and the vaccination campaign, all of these things. He did not follow through with those, and opting instead to pay back the debt that the country is under. But then at the same time, used his relationship with the United States to accumulate a lot of personal wealth. So was quite wealthy until he was ousted by popular people being like, "Listen, you know, this is he can't be president for life." So it's interesting because I do feel that Sankara was a unique person in the sense that he really did put the people ahead of his own financial gain. But who knows how long that kind of scenario would last, you know? Like, so he was only in power for 4 years. I can't make any assertions about who he would have been, you know, if he had maintained that power. I do think that such power has the capacity to corrupt, you know, and so I do think that there is, you know, as you pointed out earlier, there's often this slide into authoritarian practice by rulers who sort of, you know, initially really just want the best and are focused on the improvement of lives of the people of their country. So everything is so complicated.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I guess, you know, these are all just speaking to why the upshot of the book, which again is that we have these theories about what's going to work and then the practice of them and how those two things are often in conflict.
You're listening to Lauren Wilkinson. She is the author of American Spy, a novel that has been distinguished in a number of places like Vogue and a number of others. Lauren, let's talk a little bit about the decision you made to create this novel or form this novel in a letter to Marie Mitchell's twin sons. Again, we're not going to be giving away how this all works out. But that's rather unusual. I've never read a novel like that. And was that the very first thing you thought of? If I'm going to write this thing and if it's going to be noteworthy and distinctive, I'm going to find a different way of telling the story. And you might explain to our listeners how that unfolds.
Not at all. That was not my thing. So it is epistolary. I guess this is technically, it's one long letter, not a series. But I guess that is still an epistolary novel. So this novel is based on a short story that appeared in Granta. And that was in third person, the short story. Mm-hmm. But as I was writing the novel, I got feedback from readers and also my agent, Christina, who I couldn't have written this book without. And they were saying, she's too distant. I'm so distant from this character. I don't really understand her. And we can't have this distance with her because she has it with everybody in the story, you know? So I was really struggling with it. I couldn't make her spill her guts as a character to me and to the reader because she is a spy. And she, you know, has stayed alive because of her capacity and ability to keep secrets. So I was really struggling. And then I read Gilead by Marilyn Robinson, which has the same structure. It's a man who has had a child, a six-year-old, I believe, late in life. And he's writing to his son because he knows that he's dying and that he's not going to see him as an adult. And I was like, ah, jackpot, bingo, here's the perfect structure for me to steal. Because, you know, the one thing that I understood about Marie was that her sons are the only people that she believes deserves her full truth. So they're the only ones who she would tell everything to. And once she started talking to them, that became clear. Once she was being honest with them and in turn being honest with me and the reader.
So now you just said that these sons she could tell everything to. But there is one point in the book where she doesn't tell the sons everything. And that's when there's this love affair. Or not an affair, but there's this love making moment. And the author of this book found either a very convenient way to avoid getting into that kind of writing, or it just makes sense. If you're talking to your little boys, you're not going to want to be describing this. Could you share with us how this came to be?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it felt, well, I'm always a little bit shy just generally to write like a very explicit sex scene just because they are really, really, really difficult to write and very easy to do poorly. So I wrote that scene a lot of times. And then once I realized she was talking to her sons, it became like very tense. And I think that she does also mention that, you know, she feels uncomfortable describing sex, but doesn't feel that same way describing violence and kind of wonders about that because, you know, I wonder about that too. I felt like, oh, it would be weird for a mother to, you know, be explicit with her children about her sex life, but then not so in about, you know, violence and death. So, you know, that is, I feel like it challenged me. And then I think, oh, but it made me also think about why that might be for me.
Well, it's so interesting from the reader's standpoint because the reader, at least this reader, is building up to the point where is this relationship going and what's going to happen? I'll bet I know. And then you're thinking, this is kind of a literary novel, and I'm looking at the background of this author. This isn't a Harlequin novel, so how's she going to do this? What's going to happen? And I thought you found a very clever way of doing it, but to your point, a way that made a lot of sense because you're writing for kids. And for our listeners who are at this stage of the game trying to figure out what's this book really about, I've mentioned Marie Mitchell a few times as the protagonist, but I want you to set up who Marie Mitchell is, what her challenge of this novel is, just so we can get our listeners in better shape to buy this book and read it.
Okay, well, Marie Mitchell is a FBI agent or a former FBI agent who is approached by the CIA and recruited to help them, you know, in order to undermine and to surveil Thomas Sankara. And that request, that assignment, forces her to come to terms with a lot of things. What she believes is right, her place in the world as an American and as a Black woman. And those things are already contentious for her because she is working and very aware of herself as being a FBI agent working in an organization that undermines her and doesn't support her and doesn't feel like, you know, is for her in a lot of ways. So the book is a spy novel. It is well within the spy genre, but I do examine a lot of the intersection of race and gender and politics as well. Mm. So I use it as an opportunity to explore those things. It's my first book. I wasn't sure I'd be able to get another one out, so I figured I'd throw everything I had at it, all the things that I think about.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. There's no question that identity is a theme throughout this book. And as I'm reading it, trying to put myself in the shoes of a Black woman, or a man for that matter, who is enlisted by his country to spy and surveil, I'm thinking, I wonder how far I should go to serve a country that hasn't always served me and my people very well. That seems to be
exactly
something I'm kind of picking up in your novel, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Precisely. That's the succinct, perfect way to describe what's at the heart of this.
So there's a betrayal in the book. I guess we could talk about the real life story of the betrayal, and we've alluded to it, but can you do that without spoiling the book?
Well, there are several betrayals, and in fact, you know, I said that it was based on a short story in Granta. The theme of Granta for that issue was betrayal. So mm-hmm. betrayal is like a fundamental part of this story for sure. Campayoré betrays Sankara in real life in the pursuit of power.
And tell us who Campayoré is. Now, Campayoré is the number two guy, right?
Yes. In real life, Sankara's closest friend. They grew up together from their 20s, grew up together. They would have dinner, you know, at Sankara's home. And a series of events have happened, which I don't want to spoil, but in real life, whatever happened led to Campayoré taking power mm-hmm. and maintaining it until, I believe, 2016, from starting in 1987.
Wow. So you're in the spy genre. You going to stay there?
Actually, I don't think so. Well, yes and no. So something that really took me by surprise was about a month after my book came out, I got a phone call from a showrunner in L.A., and I spoke to him on a Friday and was out there on Monday working on a spy show, which was really, really exciting. And I'm about to start on a second spy show. They have very different energies, though. The first one is very action-packed, and the second one is more like feels more in my wheelhouse, where it is following a female spy who is, and it is more about her emotional life and relationships. So in that sense, I'm going to stay. But my next novel, I think, will be more genre, but I think maybe like a grounded superhero type of book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So how different is it writing for a show and writing a novel? What's the major difference or challenge that you face?
It's how you produce the writing. Uh-huh. You know, for one thing, say your ideas out loud to a group of people, which you're not forced to do with a book, so
right.
which is good and bad. Good yeah. because you haven't said something silly in front of a bunch of people you admire, but also bad because, you know, you stay with an idea that's not working and it takes you a lot longer
yeah.
to realize it's not working. And then also it's been more like, you know, when I wrote this book mostly in my pajamas, you know,
right.
so and at any time. I like to write very early in the morning, around 4 or 5, I like to get started. You know, you can't mm-hmm. get to dictate your time when you're working on a TV show. It's more like a 9-to-5 job. So mm-hmm. just that gear switch has been an important one, big one for me.
Wow, that is really neat. So there's an ending to this novel that I could have never predicted where it was going. And now that you mentioned that you're writing for TV and that you're writing with a group of people, or at least you're expressing orally where you're going with your plot and whatever, do you think you would have ended your novel the same way if you were sitting with a group of these TV folks talking about how this should go, how this should come down?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because for me, the real ending of this book is at the heart of her. It has to do with her children, because those are the people who are the most important to her. Mm-hmm. It's not really, you know, her biggest fear. I know what her biggest fear is, and that's what happens at the end of this book. Mm-hmm. So, it'll always, you know, it always has been that mm-hmm. to me, to kind of have the worst thing happen to her at the end, mm-hmm. which is heartbreaking, which was really hard for me to do because I really cared about this character.
Right.
But that said, I have imagined what a sequel would be like, and I think it would probably be from the first part of it would be from Ross's perspective, you know, the major antagonist in the book, and then maybe would have like a final showdown between them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would need to build that character, and I don't even know really where to begin. So, yeah.
Well, I hope you find a way to begin, because I would love nothing more than a sequel to this novel. This novel is really a good read, and I encourage our listeners, get a copy of American Spy by Lauren Wilkinson. Lauren, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
Join us next week as we talk with Sonia Purnell about her book, A Woman of No Importance. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.